Okay, we're going to get started. Today we're going to be talking about people who have had interaction with the with law enforcement. We can call it reentry transitional training. We can call it what they like to say is collateral consequences of conviction. Whatever you call it, it's people who have been arrested or convicted and are trying to reenter the workforce and have lots of baggage. And we want to talk about that because while some of the grantees have a casual relationship to people who have been incarcerated, many have driven deeper into this issue, working with ex-offenders and people who have criminal records. So we want to talk about both of those types of environmental workforce development programs that have had casual relationships and have students in their program that have issues related to their records, and then also touching on and learning from those programs that have worked more extensively with the ex-offenders. And this is an environmental workforce development job training program, and you say, why are we spending two sessions on this? Because this is a very important constituents of our population. They live in underserved populations. They're definitely not only underserved, but require a larger and larger percentage of our population. So before we get into this, we always talk about news from Washington, news from our partners, and what's going on. So, and news from HMTRI. So, Heather, do you want to give us a rundown of what's going on in Washington?
All right. Thank you all for joining us today. You know, this is just really kind of the quiet time in terms of news from HQ and from Washington. You know, this is kind of the time where they're reviewing everything that's been sent in and, you know, just kind of checking things out. So really from the HQ side of stuff, there's no real news from HQ. But we do want to always remind you guys, and this is something that we just always push, is don't forget, mark on your calendars that Brownfields 2021, the National Brownfields Conference, the date has been moved. So the date for the National Brownfields Conference has been moved to September 27th through the 30th, 2021 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Again, that's September 27th through the 30th, 2021 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And you can find more information on that in brownfields2021.org. Again, that's brownfields2021.org. HMTRI is planning on having a booth there, and we did put in and respond to the call for sessions as well. And we're even looking at having a affiliate event the day before, so maybe have a sessions special time for EWJT folks to get together and have you know, specific event that we could have all of you guys get together and learn and have a little bit of special professional development specifically for environmental workforce development and job training folk. We'll have some more details as we get a little bit closer. You know, we're just under a year out for that event, so that's still an awful long ways away for planning purposes. But again, mark it on your calendar, September 27th through the 30th, 2020, September 27th through the 30th, 2021 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. In terms of HMTRI news, the biggest thing that we wanted to share with you all was a plan to change a couple of the dates of the next coming PLCs. You know, we like to do these every 2 weeks, but, you know, in terms of some of the holidays coming up and with some of the different, you know, different things that are coming up on the calendars, we just needed, we probably looked at some of the things needing to shift a little bit. And so in response to that, I'm actually probably going to turn it over to Mike to tell you what we're looking at in terms of changing some of the dates of the next coming PLCs, just to let you know that we're going to kind of shift a few of those out. So we're probably going to have a little bit of a different gap than what we normally do, but we'll still push out the reminders like we always do, so you guys will get bombarded with those in your email inboxes. From the different listservs. So you can get reminders from the PLC listserv that comes from Mike, and as well as the normal listserv as well that comes from me. If you want to be added to any of those, just send us an email. You can do that at hkballou@eicc.edu. And we can get you added to those listservs as well.
Great. Regarding that, all we're doing is we're going to push the PLC 1 week. So that means our next PLC will be on November 18th. If we didn't do that, some people are off on Veterans Day on the 11th. So we're just going to skip a week there. Our next PLC will be November 18th. And then by doing that, we're going to go back to a two-week cycle. So we'll be able to skip Thanksgiving and do one after that, which would be December 2nd. So we do these in cycles of 10. So we're going to do one in November on the 18th, and then the final one will be December 2nd, and that'll be our last PLC for this cycle. And then we'll be taking a Christmas holiday break, and then we'll start up again in January on the 13th. And by that time, we're going to be starting to get close to the new awards, and we'll be getting a brand new cycle going. So we got two PLCs left after this one, one on November 18th and then one on December 2nd. And we'll send out notes. We try to send out plenty of notes so we hit everyone before that happens. Okay. Today, as I had mentioned, we're going to be talking about reentry, transitional training, obstacles to employment, all of those terms that strike a certain proportion of our students. Before I get into that, though, would you like to talk about partner news? One of our partners, of course, is EPA. Just want to let you know that they awarded 28 EJ grants, the environmental justice grants. They range from $120,000 to $200,000. And these grants are for community groups that are to work in their communities to look at things that are going on in their underserved communities. And in the notes, I'll indicate who those people were. They're basically community groups, and they want these groups to seek out things that are happening in their community that the underserved populations in those communities can take advantage of. And, of course, one of those is the Environmental Workforce Program. So they may be reaching out to some of you, particularly if some of those are in your community. You may want to touch base with them about your program. They'll be looking for you to see what opportunities you provide to those communities, as well as how you might be able to coordinate with them. Another announcement from one of our partners is Zender Environmental. Lynn is going to be participating in a Zoom call. It's titled EJ and Working with Federal Recognized Tribes and Indigenous People. That's going to be occurring on November 10th. So those of you who are interested in working with tribes, indigenous groups, may want to tune into that. I'll put the registration on there in the notes so you'll have them and can sign up for that program. Also, one other note of one of our alumni grantees at Coalfields, we like to follow them. They took the lead off of Recycle Force and are trying to look at recycling, and they had an electronic recycling day where they're helping their community with their solid waste and recycling needs.
Yeah.
So let's dig a little deeper into what we did last week. I want to thank Paul and Ken for their great presentations on what they were doing with their ex-offender program, which is very heavily oriented towards ex-offenders. We also have Fortune and Oberl, who are also working quite a bit with gangs and ex-offenders, and we'll be talking to Jake later about some of the work that they're doing in his community. I want to talk first about the consequences of conviction and what we have to look at. And as I said last week, the reason this touches environmental workforce people is that about 28% of the population or about 70 million people have had some run-ups with the law, and they have criminal records. Now, those may be very minor offenses. They may be misdemeanors and go up to felonies. About 59% of those are drug-related. So we have a huge drug-related either misdemeanor or felony conviction rate. Only about 11% are violent crimes. But as a result of that, of people who are serving time, we've got about 10,000 people leaving the prison system every week. So it's a considerable population. And they're going back home or to their community with a whole lot of baggage. They've got health problems. They've got drug problems that they may not have resolved. They've got mental issues problems, as Paul had mentioned last week. They often will have housing issues. They have transportation issues. They have no car. They have no money to get a car. They have problems accessing any kind of training to get some sort of credentials. And if you add up all of those issues, they have an employment problem. And that's where we come in. That's where the Environmental Workforce Development Program can come in and be a service to these underserved communities. We're talking about a growing population of people who have baggage that may be motivated and may be interested in getting into the environmental field. And this is our wheelhouse or potential of our wheelhouse. And how does it affect us? And it will affect all of our grantees with regard to your recruitment, our critical issues of recruitment, our retention, our placement, and our post-graduation services. If we have ex-offenders, people with baggage for being incarcerated, they're going to have all of these issues. And the question is, for those of us that are used to working with ex-offenders, it's one thing, but many of the grantees are not familiar with this, and they have to, I think what we're asking is we have to be sensitive to those people, because what will happen if you're not sensitive to the baggage that these people carry, there'll be dropouts, and it'll affect your retention rates, and you won't even know why. So going into this, and the purpose of this, let's identify some of the baggage that people are carrying when they come out. And there is an excellent, this was a study that I mentioned last week. It was originated by the National Bar Association, but the Department of Justice has picked it up, one of their subsidiaries, and it's called the National Inventory of Collateral Consequences of Conviction. A long name for, we've identified the baggage that ex-offenders, people who have served time, have when they get out. And it's updated regularly. It's well-funded. There was an update in 2018. There's probably an update going on now. They have identified every state, actually a total of 40,000 consequences. It's state by state. Now, here's the thing about how people deal with ex-offenders. Every state is different. This is a real diverse issue. Every state has different rules, ideas, restrictions. For example, South Carolina for a while they had SNAP. This is SNAP, the nutrition and benefit program. They would not allow that for people with to ex-offenders. Some will impact whether you can get loans or grants. Often government contracts. We've mentioned that with Santa Fe, issues of getting certainly security clearances. Licenses, getting a CDL. If you're training and doing a training program and it's integral to commercial driver's license with hazardous materials, that is identified in this database as a potential no-no. You can't do it. Certainly various occupations. Interestingly enough, if you go into this database, you'll find that hazardous materials operations in some states are prohibited by certain people with certain convictions. Now, having said this, there's a spectrum of convictions. We're talking anything from minor drug offenses to heavy felonies, violent crimes. And in between, there is a very broad spectrum. And this gets into when we start talking about measures that environmental workforce programs may want to take as far as their recruitment and how they recruit and that type of thing. So we'll talk about that in just a second. But again, keeping in mind that there is not only this whole spectrum, but there is a huge population within that spectrum. And of course, all sorts of demographics, whether they're educational disparities, might be racial disparities, might be ethnic disparities, what language you speak. So it's pointed out, one of the big issues is if you're bringing in lots of different people in a community, there may be a lot of issues that are identified in groups, or little internal tribal squabbles based on what language you're speaking is your primary language. So I'm going to reference this, and it would be worth it to you, if you're working with ex-offenders, to take a glance at it. And it's a very good tool. It's an interactive tool, and it'll zero you in by occupation, by state, by certification, and it'll even zero you in on the law. It's a very extensive database that's interactive. And the reason it's a good database to have is that courts don't have any requirement to disclose what restrictions a person might have. He may be convicted of a crime, and they're not going to tell you that, oh, by the way, you cannot ever become a barber, or you can't drive a commercial vehicle that has hazardous materials on it. They're not going to tell you those things. So it's something that if you're working more and more with ex-offenders, you may want to look at this database. And we call it the hidden restrictions, and there's tons of them. And these are things that you, as far as your program goes, want to be sensitive to. For example, many of these people will be on probation. The terms and conditions of the probation may vary widely. They may have to check in on a regular basis. They've got caseworkers visiting them. And the question is, as Paul said, they're fortunate, and the parole officers and or the caseworkers may come to them to assist their people. But if you don't have a lot of ex-offenders, they may have to go to to visit the probation officer. They may have to check in with caseworkers. They may have to go to them rather than them coming to them. Now, the issue here is attendance, and it's going to be an important issue. We have to remember that trainers, and we'll talk about this in a second, they're environmental trainers. They're not used to being sympathetic to someone missing class. And what we're concerned with is nobody may ever know that this person has to visit his parole officer or he has to visit a caseworker. He may not want to talk about it, but he'll miss class and he'll end up dropping out. This is how it affects our program. So that's just one of the hidden restitutions that may be there. Restitutions is a big issue. There's liability. They might be civil liability as a result of whatever crime. If they did a property crime, they may have money judgments, civil judgments against them. They also are going to have fines, court fines, and all sorts of charges. Paul very succinctly illustrated the issue with ankle bracelets. If they're out on parole and they're wearing bracelets that cost $14.50 a week, and the gentleman that has a conviction has to pay that. He has to get the money somewhere, in addition to any civil crimes he's committed. So what we've got is a huge pile of issues that are confronting these people. And as you go through them, you wonder, how can someone ever get through all of this? And the question for us, and it's a very callous question, is we're involved in environmental workforce development, training, bringing people into the workforce. One of our mission is to serve and assist underserved populations. Another mission is to put people into the workforce in the environmental arena to provide a supply of good workers for environmental remediation. How do we balance those two? You can be very callous and say, any ex-offender that has this baggage, that's part of our screening process. We can't let you in. We've only got so many seats, and we'll accept people with this level of problems, or we can go to the other extreme of we're going to take everyone. And where you fit in that spectrum is really how you design your program and what you feel your community mission is. And among our grantees, it does range from one extreme to the other. So let's look at our grantees in more detail and look at some of the challenges. And we're not ready to talk about best practices, although it'd be good to look at best practices. But we've got a lot of anecdotal information over the years from our grantees who have worked with ex-offenders. And let's start with the very beginning, recruitment. In fact, we call it recruitment and assessment. How do you want to recruit people that may include a population of ex-offenders? You have to be realistic, as I just said. What crimes have been committed? What sort of restitution needs to be paid? What kind of restrictions are those people going to have when they graduate your program? Are they going to be, again, if you're going to be doing CDL training and they can't get a commercial driver's license for hazardous materials, don't want to mislead them. On the other hand, if you're feeding most of your graduates into a government program that requires some sort of security clearance, or even a government program, as in Santa Fe, we've got a special situation where unless they have a special program, they can't get hired. So if we're working with asbestos and you're going into people's homes and you've got a felony conviction, is that going to be an issue? So again, the clear-cut restriction, you say, well, we can't put restrictions on our grantees. Well, the clear-cut one is violent crime. If they're involved in violent crime, that may be a no-no. Now we get into that gray area of to what extent do you screen on your recruitment? And this is, and again, you might do this on all of your grantees. What about transportation issues? Are you going to, how far do you probe into, can you get to class? If you're on one side of town and then the other, they want to join your program. There is not a bus route and they don't have a car. No transportation. Is it realistic that they're going to be able to succeed in your program? Again, we're being callous, but we're looking at success of your program and a limited number of seats that you have. If you've got 20 seats, can you afford to not be able to place or drop out, have half your dropouts or as bad, go through a 8-week program and then can't place your students? So again, while it seems a little mean or callous, again, we have to look at your program and let's be realistic. How do you run a sustainable program? If you're set up for it, fine. If you're not set up for it, think about these issues I'm bringing up real carefully. Do you know that they can attend every session? Again, if they think, well, I can't because I've got to report to a parole officer, I've got caseworker, that's okay if you know that ahead of time. And that's part of that screening process. If you know that they're going to be working with a caseworker, they're going to be working with a social worker, they're going to be working with parole officers, and they're going to have time off. You know that, and you could play it in the program, and it fits into your instruction. That's fine. If it doesn't, think about it. Think about it. Do they have other special service needs? Those might be child care, child support, child care, elder care, a whole range of things. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is that all of these issues your applicants may not want to talk about. They're applying for your program. They don't know about your program. They don't know how hard it is. They don't know the whole path, but you do. So you can't blame them for saying, oh, I could do all these things. That's fine, and not bring them up. But then when you get into the program, they're going to drop out or they can't graduate or they can't get a job. So it's not their fault. It's really on you to explain to them and make it really clear cut before you get started. And many of our programs have student contracts. You can do this. You can get to the program. You can attend every session. If you can't, let us know. We could work around it. We could do some special tutoring for you. We could have makeup sessions. Can you take the certification test? The real crime is to go through the course and then you can't make it to the certification test because you've got either a court case, a continuance of some sort, or some sort of uncancelable meeting with a caseworker or parole officer. You've got to know these things well in advance. So what am I saying as far as recruitment? And it goes into training. You almost need, in grade school, they call it an IEP. I call it an ILP, an individual learning plan. And that plan is suiting your ex-offenders. If you've got to identify them, spend a little time at recruitment. Let's not go any further than recruitment. Go start early. Find out what their special needs are, what their attendance needs are, what restrictions they're going to have when they graduate. Now you could get into this eyes wide open. You could work around it, or you may not be able to let them into the program. There are a lot of needy people that are well-deserving in your community and may not have baggage that will keep them from graduating. If someone drops out of your program, the biggest problem, when someone drops out of your program, that means there's a seat that someone could have had, a job that someone could have had, someone who is just as needy, but will be restricted from getting that. So that's definitely something to consider. So let's get into retention. I pretty much talked about that in the past, using techniques that you could use to keep people in the program. Is everyone with me now?
Yes.
Heather, are you here? Okay, I just wanted to make sure. I had my phone's on the other side of the room, and I had an e-message, or someone tweaked me, and I just wanted to make sure that I was not talking to thin air here. I'm going to go on and, excuse me, would someone like to add something to what I've just said so far? Okay. Let's get into retention as it involves environmental workforce development job training programs. This is a best practice, I consider, and Paul talked about it, and Ken Alexander talked about it last time. Extensive use of circles. A lot of our programs that work with ex-offenders and a lot of programs that don't work with ex-offenders do the circles. And what is a circle? Every morning, you get in a circle and you BS. You just talk about problems, programs, questions, what we're going to do today. You might have a motivational person who has been in the program that came to visit, said, I was in this circle 2 years ago, and I've got this great job, or I'm looking for people, and this is, we're looking for workers. So it's a circle where you do nothing, but you accomplish a lot. And some people do one big circle, others do smaller circles. Now, having said that, the big circle is good, but to the extent that you could do a big and a smaller circle, the smaller circles is more intimate and interaction between individuals in the circle. You're more likely to get onto the personal level, the smaller circles. What are we trying to do with circles? We're trying to establish a relationship between a mentor or mentors and the mentee and the person that might need assistance, need some help. So what happens in a circle, it's no different than an Al-Anon or whatever. You're getting into a group, and everyone, to the extent that everyone talks about their problems, it may not have any relationship to environmental workforce development or job training. It's about their life and getting through this. Obviously, people with reentry issues may have more problems. You may have a reentry circle, those people who are transitioning, people that have childcare or family support issues, people with transportation issues. So again, the purpose is to link mentors and mentees. And we find that often, to the extent that it happens not you don't force it to happen, but when elders work with younger people, it is a mentor relationship that's non-competitive and works really well. And it tends to happen naturally. People who have been there, done that, can relate much better to someone much younger. Perhaps sometimes within younger people can relate to each other and might have a more competitive social environment. But that's something that happens naturally, but it happens in these circles. Another thing that happens, and this is prior to doing the circles, are workouts, morning workouts to break the ice. We call them boot camps. Art Shanks, he made extensive use of that. Dwayne Johnson, a gentleman out of East Palo Alto a long time ago, he was an ex-Green Beret, and he started this idea of let's go for a mile, 2 mile run. Everybody runs. And of course, Art's program has uniforms. Dwayne's, I don't know if he had uniforms or not, but they would do exercises. If they couldn't run, they would do calisthenics. It breaks the ice, gets them out of their old mode, whatever that thinking was they had, negative thinking, negative thoughts. It clears their minds, and then you can go into circles. Now, we're spending a lot of time on non-environmental training here, but why are we doing it? It has to do with retention, and it has to do with graduation. And actually, it has to do with the rest of their lives. So these are really important things. If you don't have some sort of interaction internally, this has been done other ways. We've had programs that they weren't dealing with ex-offenders, but they had social nights, and they would meet at a bar or tavern or some meeting place, which is difficult to do now, but they would just have a lot of socials. And they did it completely different. They had these social activities, which kind of evolved into a type of circle where people would just get around and talk and shoot the breeze. But again, what we're trying to do with boot camps, we want to clean their slate with circles. We want to start establishing mentoring relationships. This peer-to-peer mentoring is probably the most important thing that you're going to have of all the things that you could do in retention. This is probably the most important thing. We've had many, many cases where someone said, I'm dropping out, and his classmates supported him. They're going to keep him in that program. And he's not going to drop out because his friends are there. And those friendships also emulate, they go way beyond graduation, because those people get into a job with someone, they're going to bring his friend in. These are those hidden benefits and hidden strategies that can make your program very successful, and you're not going to be thinking about them on a superficial scale. You could do other things as far as retention. You can provide the legal aid, definitely, when they go to court. You could help them expend your records. You can do the housing and transportation services. Many of our grantees won't be able to do that, or they don't have partners. Some can. Ubro, fantastic program. They can help with housing. They could help with legal aid. They could help with health services. Many of our grantees that are ex-offenders have mental issues, and they need help. They've got in-house caseworkers. So they have all of those. They could supply the individual help to people. Now, out of 50 grantees, we may have half a dozen that are able to do that, but many don't have the capability, and they have not established that partner network where it's really they've got a much more narrow focus on environmental training. So they're not able to do that. But if you take as a general rule, and just keep this in mind, that you need to make every participant in your program feel that he's wanted in that program and that he has a path to help through the program. He has a friend in that program. Art was a master at this. Any one of his students could go to Art with a personal problem, and he helped many people with personal problems. He would appear at court for them. He'd vouch for them. This also helps when it's time for recommendations. Now, the larger your program, the harder this is. But for a group of 20, if you've got 20, there's no reason why you can't get to know personally every one of those people. We've got many programs, and not only those, the people, they know their families very well. So this is a practice that, again, you want to keep in mind as you're developing your program. Again, many of you start working with 100% or 80% ex-offenders, but keep it in mind if you have any. Now, here's an issue when we talk about training. The problem we have in training, if you go to environmental trainers and engineers, okay, they learned up in the university, they learned their education university, they've got their credentials. They're used to standing in the front of the room, and everyone's at full attention, and they're listening to them and every word they're saying. And this is not true of all, maybe not even half, but many don't have the tolerance that may be required to working with ex-offenders or people who have been out of school for many years and are not used to learning or being in a classroom setting. You may have to, and you may want to do this anyway, when you're vetting your trainers, talk to them. Have they ever worked with people in transition? Have they really worked with people who haven't been in a classroom for 20 years? People who are not used to cracking the books or looking at the books or don't read. They don't use that approach. Many will use hands-on. They're much more comfortable in role play or in demonstrations or hands-on activities. And in choosing your trainers, you may want to migrate to someone who is a tactile, a hands-on person, likes role plays, likes demonstrations, hands-on, less in terms of reading books, more in terms of team building and working with hands and demonstrations and little competitive games that essentially teach. On the training side, again, this applies definitely to people in transition, but it will apply to a lot of the other people. And lastly, I want to talk about placement. These are the same issues as we talked about today earlier. People with baggage are going to have all these problems with placement that I've just mentioned that you're having as a trainer. If you were realistic in recruitment, you're going to end up with some motivated people who know that there are going to be challenges ahead of them getting a job. They'll know what they can do, what they can't do. They'll learn areas that they may want to work in. Now, you've worked really well on the student side and the people that are in your programs. Now you've got to spend some time on the employer side. And this is also critical. You have to develop a relationship with employers. And doesn't matter how many ex-offenders you have. You've got to work with employers that are willing to hire ex-offenders, people with criminal records. Now, many states, we have banned the box. In the initial interview, his record is not an issue. It does become an issue, though, after that. So the employer you need to be honest with the employer. And in fact, our grantees have said, you never let a student, a graduate, go out on an interview if he's got an issue with reentry. You never let him go out on an interview unless you've talked to that employer about his situation, about his restrictions, about the fact that he may have parole officers, he may be missing some days, and the relationship with the employer has to be personal with that person. I understand, I know your baggage, and then we can work around that. If you don't have that understanding, he's going to be gone. He won't last. On the other hand, if you've got a special program where very large institutions have special ex-offender programs because there are so many people coming out with baggage, they say, we can put them in a special program. We can be patient. We can be tolerant. We could understand, as long as they communicate with us, that they won't be here that day or they've got restitution issues, they've got court hearings, they've got other issues that they've got to clear up. We can do that. You need to work on the employer side. Again, you won't be able to place your people unless it's by sheer luck and they don't mention anything, and then they'll be fired or they'll be gone in a short time. So if you could look for special programs, there are surprisingly lots of employers who want to help people and many employers have been there themselves. We find that many in the environmental area, which is similar to construction, were ex-offenders themselves, people who started companies. They had been there, done that, and they're very sympathetic to people who are in the position they were at one time. So here, when you're developing your program to begin with and you're doing your grant proposal, you need to start looking at those contacts who would hire those people in your program, and it may be one or two, it may be more, that would look at considering hiring them before you go, before you even start recruitment process. Get your employers lined up to make sure that, okay, I may have a few people, they've got these issues, and the first thing they're going to ask is, what are the issues? Misdemeanors? Are they drug issues? Are they still on drugs? Do we have a problem with that? Will they do random drug tests? Are you testing before they graduate? They may ask you those questions. You can use those questions from your employer to go back and design your screening recruitment assessment of your grantees. Again, we're looking at the whole system so they can flow through successful. So again, we're at the final stages where placement, which is this whole program is about. And of course, there is some postgraduate follow-up support. Some of our programs provide considerable support to our graduates. They might include refreshers, mentoring, and the postgraduate support goes two ways. They may be mentors for your younger kids, your younger participants. They may participate in your refresher courses. As importance to you, they may serve as potential recruiters for your other ex-offenders. So we find that often if someone gets into a program, they're an ex-offender and they get into a company that is, and they're doing well, they may be looking for more. I got in, you could get in. I'll recommend you. So they can be your best placement advocate looking forward as far as the post-placement. So what I've done here is kind of go through just to make sure that all of our grantees are aware of the problems that people who have served time have when they get out, and not necessarily that all of you are going to be dealing with these issues, but some of you will be dealing with a few of these issues and should be sensitive to them. And then some of you have gotten deeper into this, and we all need help in finding out what you're doing to promote these, what we call best practices for placing these students. I would like to spend a few minutes with Jake, with Obro. Jake, this is an incredible program. They provide the whole range of services that we've had them on the PLC before. They provide everything I just talked about, and Jake's done above and beyond more than with the Environmental Workforce Program. But tell us, Jake, about what you've been doing with the people we've been talking about.
Sure. And you did touch on a lot. There's a lot to unpack with individuals with a criminal background, and each case is so different. But I'll start off with a recent success story. In our recent cohort of graduates who went through OSHA 40 Hazwoper and licensed state asbestos worker, we had a smaller class, so out of our nine individuals that went through the class, we actually had seven with either criminal background or have been on probation or even juvenile backgrounds. One of those individuals was actually incarcerated for 25 years and had just got out 2 years prior to joining our program. And was recently able to land himself a job at Flagger Force's second chance employer with us. But as you were going through, there are so many things to talk about, and I'll try to keep it down to a few concise points. When working with reentrance, there's more relationships that you have to sustain and to sustain them effectively, and those are relationships with the individuals themselves, their support networks, their probation officers. We have great support from probation officers that sort of help us keep our ear to the ground on when our individuals have court cases. And whenever they have court cases, we'll support them with letters saying, hey, this individual's in our program, trying to better their lives, put themselves in a better situation. On a side note, those letters have actually gotten some of our individuals better outcomes from their court hearings. There's also relationships, like you said, you have to maintain with the employers. Lucky for us, the trainers that we work with have already established relationships with employers that hire individuals who are of the reentry population. There is that extra mile that you have to go to sort of, you know, take the curtain off and see what are the things that these employers have decided to prohibit individuals from work. And as you said, the ones that are sort of maybe independent contractors who can make their own rules, they're not tied down to a corporate standard of backgrounds. Those are the ones we have had a lot of success placing individuals in, because that gives the individuals the chance to go and explain their situation, explain the training they have just done and their goals now. There's a whole lot to unpack and explain and a lot of program details, so feel free to send everyone my email for any types of questions or practices, but if I keep talking, I'm worried I'll go on longer and longer, but those are the concise points I've picked up on.
Oberl has been there and done that, and certainly if you're a program that's looking more and more into reentry or transitional training as it relates to green jobs, environmental training, get in touch with Jake. They've got a great program, and I'm sure next year when we will be starting up again, we'll have Jake talk in more detail about some of these issues. As I said, it's a huge area. And in these two sessions we've done with Jake and with Paul Simmons, we're just touching the edge of this. And it's more of an awareness for those of you who may be brushing the legal system and brushing ex-offenders so that you're aware of what you may be up against on the negative side and what the positives are in terms of assisting and helping your community. These people have nowhere else to go. So the benefit you provide the community is enormous, but certainly the challenges are. So does anyone have any questions or anything like
yes.
they would like to discuss here? Go for it.
I have a question. My name is Dr. Robinson, and I'm the senior pastor of Pre for Evergreen. That is an environmental social justice faith-based ministry. And we're headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina. We just opened up a satellite in New Jersey and attempting to do likewise in Puerto Rico. And so we also work with, we use the term returning citizens versus ex-cons or ex-offenders. When you talk about relationships and you talk about, you know, working with individuals who are formerly incarcerated or currently under parole, probation supervision, you know, some of their mindset from some of the previous treatment that they've gotten during their time of incarceration has not necessarily been, you know, friendly or pleasing. On the flip side of the coin, it's belittling, degrading. So when you say, I'm looking at your paperwork, your application, I see you're an ex-offender. Well, in the minds of some of these individuals, you know, that's like talking down to them or degrading them. So how do you expect to access their world when they already see you as being a judgmental person? You call me an ex-offender. And we know that's the term that DOC uses or parole uses as an ex-offender or ex-felon. But we, on the other hand, as providers and from the communities of faith, they're still people. They're returning citizens, and if they've rehabilitated themselves, they've reconditioned their mental capacity, their mindsets, they're now law-abiding citizens trying to position themselves to become taxpayer citizens and major contributors. But I just wanted to ask, is there a contact for Mr. Jake?
Yes, I'll put them in the notes. But Jake, could you give your email address? Okay, I will put them. Are you currently getting our notes from the PLC?
Yeah, I got one today, and that's why I was able to join in.
Okay,
and,
on the call.
Yes.
Could you give me your email?
Yes, my email is jrobinson243.gy@gmail.com. So it's
It's J Robinson, no periods, 243.gy@gmail.com. Okay. We send out, we have a special PLC list. And if you may have gotten one from our listserv or from our participant list, why don't you also send your, and this goes for anyone who's not getting the PLC notes that we send out on Friday, send them to Heather. Heather, do you want to give them your email address?
Yeah, absolutely. It is hkballou@eicc.edu. Again, that's hkballou@eicc.edu.
If you don't get notes.
I'm sorry.
Repeat that again.
That's LOU@EICC.
Yes.
.edu.
Yep, stands for Eastern Iowa Community Colleges.
Okay.
So hkballou@eicc.edu. Anyone who is not getting his possession notes Friday afternoon, just send Heather your email and tell him you'd like to be put on the PLC list.
Okay. And we attempted to try to apply for EPA funding grant a few years back, and we weren't able to secure it. But, you know, nevertheless, we were doing this type of work through our ministry before we even knew anything about applying for grants. But we developed a model that does training for returning citizens, veterans with disabilities, and people with disabilities on material handling. We're able to get service contracts from entities like Sunoco Recycling, who was a major provider for the Kmart Industries, and you know we were subcontracted to process their super sandwich bales, and in the super sandwich bales, you have like 17 plus mixed commodities from cardboard to clothing to all kinds of plastic film, PET plastic, high-density, low-density plastics, rigid plastics.
Well, you're a candidate for another. I want to say this to everybody on the call. These are annual grants that go out. They're three-year grants, but they're awarded annually. The next round will be probably in the springtime of 2021, which is not that far off. And we also tell people, if you apply and you're rejected, apply again. To contact the regional coordinator, they will go over where the deficiencies are in your grant. And often they're fairly simple things to correct. We also suggest to people that, particularly new people, if you don't get it the first year, many people don't get it the first year. So the big mistake is when you don't get it the first year, you don't reapply. So my advice to you, Dr. Robinson, is to reapply on the next round. And it's also, of course, self-serving. Attend our PLCs next year before it's time to send in this proposal, which will be late summer. We go over that RFP or RFA and how you may need to respond to that to be successful. So it sounds like you're doing some good work, so keep it up. Okay. Keep it up.
So
any other comments from anyone? Well, now remember, our next PLC and the second to the last will be on November 18th. So we'll send out notices, and we'll see you then.
All right. Looking forward to it.
Well, thanks, everybody. And we'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Have a blessed one.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.